Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute of Kaplan Company and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting here from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm going to be talking to you this week about some of the key issues that took place here the week of October 30th as we come up with what's been happening just recently in the area of federal taxes. This week, we're going to have a few things coming up. We're going to take a look at the House kicking off the tax reform process. We'll take a look at a taxpayer who discovered that despite the court agreeing that they had a theft loss, a rather unusual situation, or somewhat, shall we say, sympathetic situation, the court wasn't so sympathetic as to allow their guesses at what their loss were. We had a taxpayer that found an expert's testimony really doesn't substitute for having records for cost of goods sold. We have another case where we get information about what makes an IRS summons to a third party for information on a tax matter to be acceptable to the court. And we'll talk about an IRS memo that took a look at certain structures that might cause a 403B plan sponsored by a church to be undertaking transactions that are prohibited under the law that could disqualify the 403B plan. In this particular case, we're looking at indirect loans back to the employer. Well, it's again another week coming here in October. And I wanted to bring up, though, you're thinking forward into the rest of this year, thought I'd bring up that I have a couple of days coming up in December in Boise if you're planning out the rest of this year. So those of you up in Idaho, we'll be doing sessions for advanced partnership issues featuring the new partnership audit regime on December the 11th. That's going to talk a lot about the issues we're going to be facing as, in case you're not aware, watch your calendar, January 1st, 2018 is coming. We're going to begin the first year where the new partnership audit rules apply. And if you say, wait, I haven't had a partnership audit in years, these rules will also apply when you simply try to revise a partnership return you previously filed under a year that's covered by it. So it's one of those things you need to get up to speed on, and probably best you understand it before people start rewriting partnership agreements and you're called in to talk about it. So on December the 11th, we'll spend time dealing with that. December the 12th, we'll do a course that looks at a bit broader issues for both partnerships and S corporations, we pass through entities advanced issues. There we'll talk about some matters that impact both S corporations and partnerships. These courses will be held at the Idaho Society's training facility in Boise, but they'll also be available for those who reside outside of the Treasure Valley area as a webcast. If you're interested in any of these courses, you can register online at the Idaho Society site at www.idcpa.org. Well, as I said, we're getting into tax reform now. And this week, an important step took place to go down the process of getting us tax reform, assuming the process actually moves along and gives us a bill. But this first step is an important first step. The House passed House Concurrent Resolution 71, and that was the budget reconciliation resolution. It was a House budget arrangement. They accepted the Senate's version of the budget bill. That's important because they have to have a reconciliation bill in place, not so much for the House to deal with this legislation, but for the Senate to be able to deal with the legislation and not have to worry about obtaining 60 votes to overcome an objection to voting on the bill. So this was important. The House picked this up. It was also important to save time. Remember, the goal right now is to get a bill out by the end of December. In order to save lots of time, it would be a lot simpler if the House simply passed the bill the Senate had already passed, rather than making some of their own changes to the budget instructions and then having to go to a conference committee. In fact, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee had estimated that having to go back to conference could push the process back 12 days, which when you're aiming for this close to the end of the year and the number of days, you consider things like Thanksgiving recess and other issues in the way and just other matters Congress will have to deal with, losing 12 days be a big thing. The vote was a narrow one, though. They'd only passed the House by 216 to 212 votes. Now, while that is a four-vote differential, as makes sense if you think about it, what happens if somebody flips their vote, had two additional House members gone from the yes camp to the no, this vote would have failed. So it was a very narrow passage that raises some concerns about how the whole tax reform process is going to go, because having these super narrow votes starts getting some people thinking about the health care whole debacle that took place and the problems it had there, scraping together a bare majority in the House and then becoming unable to scrape together a majority in the Senate. But in this particular case, the vast majority of the 20 Republicans who voted no on this resolution was directly related to the issue of the deduction for state and local income taxes, or what we're going to return to, what we're going to keep calling the SALT issues. Now, we're used to talking about that state and local taxes as SALT. You probably heard that acronym before, but a lot of people in general press haven't. So now you're going to hear a lot of words about SALT. It's suddenly going to become one of those things that has become a new buzzword for the press. So we'll hear a lot about this discussion. Now, that vote probably indicates, I think, a couple of things. First, many of the 20 that voted against probably only voted against after they became it became clear the bill was going to pass, that it had 216 votes. So basically, it would have enough votes to go through. At that point, they felt they could safely vote no, so they probably could tell their constituents that they were fighting to preserve their state and local tax deductions. Most of these Republicans were from New Jersey, New York, those areas, high tax areas. And the other side effect of this, though, was a number of members from high tax states, Republican members, voted yes, but that seems likely based on the assurance that there would be a SALT deal. So it's a little bit iffy. How this SALT thing works out could be very important. The other problem, of course, is this is just the first of many issues where we're going to discover that people whose ox is being gored suddenly aren't so happy to go along with the program. And as those of us remember 1986 and the last time we did comprehensive tax reform, we're going to have to gore a few oxes along the way. There are going to be losers. It's the nature of the process. You can't really design a program that does comprehensive reform where absolutely no one pays more tax than they did before. That simply isn't the way you can make this function, at least not in any reasonable form. Now, the bill is going to be dropped, and that's the term the House Ways and Means use, which means it'll be made public on November 1st. That's this coming Wednesday. Just a forewarning, I am going to hopefully be able to look at that bill once it's dropped, assuming it does come down on Wednesday. And hopefully next week's broadcast, I'll outline for you what is in that bill. Remember, it won't be law because bills are not law. They're just proposals and very well may be changed even before it leaves the House due to amendment processes. But we'll at least understand what the initial goal of the reform is. And this will kind of put us on the starting point and give us the broad outline of what would like to be changed. And then we'll start talking about what happens to the bill later. The Ways and Means plans to begin hearing shortly thereafter on November 7th. So we'll see hearings start the following Monday. At that point, they hope to have this passed and out of the House by Thanksgiving. That would move it on to the Senate, where they hope the Senate will mainly accept what the House comes up with. We'll see how that works. A couple of issues to remember. The SALT issue is going to be a bigger issue in the House and the Senate. Many of those states where the Republican congressman came from that are high tax states that are voting against the bill in the House, those particular states have only Democratic senators who are going to vote against this bill likely regardless. So the SALT deal could be interesting, that the SALT deal may not be acceptable to the Senate, even though it may be necessary to get it through the House. This is going to be a complicated issue. Just keep your eyes on it. Let's go on to actual developments this week then. We're going to start with the case of Partika versus Commissioner. This is a tax court summary opinion, 2017-79. It was issued on October the 25th of 2017. And this deals with a taxpayer who, well, they had kind of a sad situation occur. What happened to them was they lent to what can best be called a really bad tenant with a long history of cheating landlords. Of course, they didn't know that when they rented to the person. The person had approached them and wanted to purchase a bunch of the furnishings in the property, and then they wanted to rent the property. And they gave the taxpayer a check for a few thousand dollars to cover both what they'd agreed to pay for the furnishings, about $5,000, and their first month's rent. First month's rent, security deposit, all those neat things. Well, unfortunately for the taxpayer, they got the check just as they moved in. And when they deposited the check, you know, you get that little notice a couple days later from the bank. that tells you that check just bounced. And so they discovered that, hey, you know, I've got a bad check. That always gives you a bad feeling with a brand new tenant. The check you were given is bad. And it turns out the bad feeling was right. The tenant never could replace the check with a valid check. They kept dodging it. They started eviction proceedings, but it got worse. After they evicted the tenant, they discovered the tenant had pulled up with rental trucks and basically carted off almost all of the furnishings inside the house. Not just the ones they were supposed to buy, they took everything, all the way down to the curtains. So everything had left the place. Now, for some reason, when the landlord got back in, there was still one rental truck left at the location. So they took that truck and ended up getting into that truck, getting some things back. But then they had to pursue the tenant. They got the sheriff's office involved. They did find the tenant. The sheriff's office began to work with them to separate their belongings from the former tenant's belongings in the truck. But this took a while because, you know, the tenants had intermingled their stuff with the taxpayer stuff, and they had to go through and satisfy the sheriff that the property was theirs. And so they got late in the day. The sheriff basically decided to tell them, well, I want to go home. You know, we'll just come back in the morning and finish this up. Well, when the morning came, it turns out the truck and the tenants were long gone. The taxpayer continued to try to figure out if they could recover the money. They got more details together about what had been taken, and they consulted attorneys and discovered that this wasn't the first time these guys had offered to buy furnishings and then gave bum checks, stiffed the landlord, and walked off with all the furnishings. So this couple apparently had a long history of doing this sort of thing. They also discovered that the couple really was uncollectible, very tough to find. They effectively eventually were counseled that there really was no purpose in pursuing this because although they had a full right to reimbursement, actually getting it was going to be highly unlikely. So they did claim a loss in 2012. This initial thing started in 2011. The court was very much agreed that that was a loss, and 2012 was the year because it was the year there was no reasonable prospect to obtain back the goods in question or to be paid for them. But the court had a real problem with how they documented their amounts. The taxpayers had claimed nearly $30,000 worth of losses. But the court took a look at the evidence offered, and on a list of items totaling nearly $7,000, they found no evidence whatsoever to support any valuation for those items. There was nothing to reasonably value them. They also found that they had done things like use replacement costs for draperies, which would be far higher than the value of draperies that have been used for a while. They also came up with a similar new style value for the bedding, for the bed, bedding, and other items. Again, not considering that these are used items. So the court decided that, in fact, the allowed amount of the deduction should be far less than $10,000 once the court looked at the information. Now, the court finished that and then came back and said, taxpayers, we agree that you had a loss, but you had so grossly overestimated the value and hadn't done your effectively necessary due diligence to come up with proper numbers that, in fact, we agree with the IRS that you should be penalized the 20% penalty under 6662 for having had a gross understatement of taxes. And for that reason, you know, you owe the penalty. There was no reasonable cause. They had sought guidance about how to claim a casualty loss, but they never presented evidence they had sought guidance on how to value the property. And they, you know, the court said, well, you didn't rely on a professional because you never showed us that you asked the professional what would be the good methods to use to try to value the property. Key takeaway from this: you got to watch things. Even when you have a sympathetic situation, it doesn't mean that you can just kind of, you know, go roughshod and just take numbers out of thin air. I'm sure that the taxpayers in this case, for good reason, you know, felt that they had been abused by the tenant, which they had, you know, and they felt, and it's very easy in that case to get really upset and to start to feel like what was taken from you was worth perhaps more than it really was, because you're just upset at being taken that way. The problem in this case was, though, You got to have evidence to back this up of some sort, and they simply didn't have it. And what the court found in some cases were the methods they had used ignored the fact that something that is used is clearly not worth as much as something that is new. Next up, another interesting problem. This is Feinberg versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-211. This case came down on October the 24th. This case is an interesting case, and it's one of two cases dealing with Colorado marijuana dispensaries this week and the wondrous Section 280 Cap E, although the second one more directly deals with a different issue, that is what's appropriate for the IRS to seek as information on exam. And we'll talk about that. That case is interesting this way, but this is a case that reillustrates the fun of Section 280E. We have seen more and more states have decided to make legal in some form the sale of marijuana either as a medical treatment, so you need a prescription to get it, or simply as Colorado did, allowing recreational marijuana use, and that will be considered legal. Now, that's all well and good, but the federal government still considers this a controlled substance. Section 280E of the Internal Revenue Code specifically provides that if you have a trader, if you're in the trader business of trafficking in a controlled substance, you essentially get no deductions other than your cost of sales. Now, that's kind of counterintuitive because it seems like, wait, the illegal item is the one thing you claim a deduction for? But it went back to some concerns when they passed this law long ago about whether constitutionally the income tax amendment would allow you to ignore cost of sales. And it's based on a bunch of law. We won't go back into why, but this is why Congress decided 280E, they just threw out the other deductions. In any event, when they prepared the return for this particular dispensary, an S-corp return, obviously the people working on the return didn't understand 280E at all, because they put most of the expenses, including ones that clearly should have been cost of goods sold, down below that portion on there where it's just the general expenses on the 1120S. Well, the IRS examined the dispensary. The IRS actually moved expenses from that lower section into cost of goods sold. So they actually allowed a greater cost of goods sold than was on the original return. But obviously, they disallowed all of the other expenses. Okay, so that's kind of the way it works. So that's kind of bad, obviously. You know, if you're the taxpayer, this is going to get very expensive. So the taxpayer decided, well, you know, maybe the IRS wouldn't be the most, shall we say, expansive in their view of what's cost of goods sold in this case. So they went out and got an expert. But the problem was they didn't produce any records to support things. So the expert was stuck with trying to come up with a reason why cost of goods sold should be greater, but doing so by effectively, you know, having to work from no records. So he said, well, he was supposed to be an expert in cost of goods sold for marijuana dispensaries. And that's fine. But remember, he had no records to work from. The court, of course, the IRS was suspicious from the first and said, well, there's no point in this. They don't have records. They can't possibly prove anything's greater. Well, the court said, you know, we're not going to necessarily totally reject it just based on that theory. However, we do have some issues. So we'll take a look at the report. Some problems they report there. Is that they just didn't like the form of the report. Let's start with some problems they found in the report. They note the report stated the tax years and issues, the average wholesale purchase price for medical marijuana remained between $2,000 and $3,000 per pound. Basically, it just says it posits an average purchase price of $2,500 per pound and then reconstructs income and expense schedules, assuming that they had a cost of goods sold equal to 55% of gross sales. The problem is the report never explains essentially how or on what basis the expert decided 55% was appropriate. And the exhibits didn't have any records or any other documents to support this 55% test. I mean, for instance, you could have looked at current year sales potentially and maybe determined from records you could get right now, even if you didn't have the old records, that you could figure out something, but that wasn't produced in here. Okay, the report also asserts the tax returns prepared shows the actual cost of goods sold for the year was between 66 and 100%. You know, in these sorts of things, in various ones where they did real returns. So they're saying, you know, 55 was low. Well, the court said they're not really going to go with that. They said, here's the problem. That report was brief, summary, and because of that, its content's unreliable. The statements in the report don't refer to the underlying source of information. The fact that you claim to be an expert is not helpful for an expert report. Rather, as an expert, you're supposed to give backup. Why? As an expert, you had a reason for deciding it was 55%. You're supposed to supply the court with references to your backup material as to why you thought it was 55. Being an expert does not allow you to pronounce numbers by fiat, and that's really important to understand in the area of being a expert witness, right? Basically, the other problem the court had was this expert had no real direct knowledge of the taxpayer's business. He was trying to reconstruct off general purposes. There's no personal knowledge. You need to have some substantiation of their expenses, and you can't really do a reconstructed return based on industry averages. Does not, in the court's term, take the place of substantiation and does not help determine a fact and issue. And the bottom line test is an expert's report will be rejected if it doesn't help the court determine the fact, which was a problem. The other catch was the report went on and did one thing you are absolutely never doing a report. You start telling the court what the law is. And what I think happened here was the CPA in question tried to make statements which really should have been made by the petitioner's counsel, which went and said why X, Y, and Z that the IRS had not moved to cost of sales should be cost of sales. The problem with that is that that's kind of a legal determination of what is cost of sales. And that sort of legal determination is really one that is a position that should have been advanced by the attorneys for this person, not by the expert. You can't rely on an expert to do that. Obviously, the catch is, as the court would say, this is a legal discussion, and a legal discussion goes under different rules. So because of that, what happened is the IRS found, or the court found, that the expert's opinion was not useful for a number of reasons. And so because of that, the IRS adjustments were sustained as they had been originally provided for by the agent. Next up, and as I said, for some reason, they're getting into these dispensaries in Colorado because this is the second Colorado dispensary case of this week. This is Rifle Remedies LLC versus United States. This is from the United States District Court of Colorado, case number 1:17MC00062. This was issued on October the 26th of 2017. Now, this particular case deals with a problem that we run into with the taxpayer worrying about a summons. The IRS had served a summons on the Colorado Department of Revenue's Marijuana Enforcement Division for information they had regarding the activities of this taxpayer. Now, you register with that division basically, if you are selling marijuana. Marijuana is, as we've mentioned, a controlled federal substance. Under 280E, obviously, if this trade or business is primarily involved in the sale of a controlled substance, it's not going to be allowed any trade or business deduction under 162. But the taxpayer objected to the summons and tried to get it quashed. The taxpayer complained that this was really just a front for the IRS's criminal investigation of the taxpayer, and that in fact, because of that, it was being used for a criminal investigation, that it really shouldn't be allowed to get that information from the state under the guise of doing so for their, you know, for their tax information. Well, the court said, okay, guys, this is going to be a tough one for you to carry. And this is probably what's important for most of us here, because again, most of us probably don't represent marijuana dispensaries, although some people do, I suspect. And if you do, obviously 280E is a big problem. But even if you don't, the question of when can the IRS get information is really important. Basically, the IRS has a right to get information according to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and this is fairly standard across the country. The IRS just merely needs to initially show in what the court, the 10th Circuit refers to as a light burden, is they've got to show the investigation is being constructed pursuant to a legitimate purpose. In this case, to determine if the taxpayer is dealing in marijuana, you know, basically a controlled substance. Second, it has to show the information being sought may be as opposed to will be relevant. They don't have to show the information will be relevant, but that it could be. That's a very broad standard. But in this case, seems clear. If you've registered with the state of Colorado and say that you're selling marijuana, then that's probably a significant issue in determining whether you are a 280E impacted entity. The information was not already in possession of the IRS. Well, nobody claims that was true. They didn't have it. And the IRS has followed all the administrative steps, and the taxpayer wasn't claiming that hadn't happened. So the court found that that was good. Now, at that point, you still can win you can still win to block the summons, but now it becomes much more difficult. The burden shifts to the taxpayer. You have to show enforcement would constitute an abuse on the court's process or that the IRS lacked institutional good faith in issuing the summons, neither of which the taxpayer did in this case. So ultimately, the court concluded the IRS had the right to that information from the state of Colorado, and the taxpayer had no right to block them from getting it. This will apply not just in a case like this, where you're looking at something, you know, for where this person is obviously afraid of criminal prosecution, but it also comes up in other cases and under very similar test applies for information the taxpayer has to provide. For instance, I've heard a lot of people talk about whether you have to provide the IRS with the QuickBooks data file when the IRS requests it. And the reality is that ship sailed a couple of years ago. Basically, the same rules apply. Could that information, and what they're after, let's be honest, is the metadata that's in the file. That's not just the entries, but things like when was the entry made? Who made the entry? You know, did it turn out that we didn't actually get the final inventory adjustment in there until after everything else was done? And then magically, cost of sales amounted to bringing this corporate income right down below $100,000. Isn't that convenient that that happens every year? Well, that could be evidence, especially when it's always an adjusting entry made by the tax preparer just before the return goes in. You might find the clients make notes in the file that are useful. All of that could be useful. That's why it works. It is a very low bar what the IRS has to show to get it information. Keep that in mind and make sure your clients understand that. Finally, we're going to take a look at an IRS chief counsel advice that looked at a church retirement plan. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2017-42022. This one was issued on October the 20th, 2017. The IRS looks at two different situations in this case, and it involves entities that were offered as investments, so you can invest in these entities in the church's 403b9 plan, and these entities made loans to the sponsoring church. Now, in the first case, what happened was that it goes on to describe these situations. One of these is you could invest in this limited liability company. It's structured so its primary function is to offer loans to this church. And the investment return to that is interest paid by the church's loans. So this entity is formed, its purpose is to loan money to, you know, this particular church. But it's not controlled by the church. Let's say other people, somebody independent from the church controls it. But the only thing this thing does is loans money to the church. That is considered to be an indirect loan to the church. The second situation it considered was because, and it's indirect loan because it's the same as if it's just directly loaning money to the church. Everybody participating knows, and the church knows that money, you know, when they offer this investment, that money will go from the plan to this organization, then will come right back to the church. That's a problem. The other investment option in this case is a organization, another LLC. It is controlled by the church, but its primary function was not loaning to the church. Nevertheless, eventually this thing loans to the church. That's also going to be a disqualifying. The plan can't do that. And this is a disqualifying event, which is what makes it so bad. That is, it blows up the plan. You cannot do this. Now, it goes on to give an example, though, of what would be okay as an investment. And at the end of it, it says, if the asset of the account were invested in a publicly traded stock of a bank, let's say, and they get it. So we invest funds in Chase. And eventually, Chase makes a loan to the church. That's not prohibited because the church does not control Chase, and Chase is not primarily in the business of loaning to that church. Jamie Dimon will tell you that for sure. So we're going to be pretty safe in saying that that's how it works. Be careful here, because what happens sometimes is, like, and I think the second example is the one that's more likely to be a problem. You know, maybe the church controls an organization. We've decided it's okay to offer investments in that organization because it doesn't do anything wrong with the church. It's been operating for 10 years. What happens in churches is we get new ministers, we get new boards. So nobody's there who was there when it's first structured. Now suddenly the church needs money for an emergency. They look over there. This entity has excess funds. They figure they can loan it to the church to just cover this problem. And it's going to be a great interest rate. It'll be a great return to the participants. So it won't even be a bad deal. And by the way, we never talked here about whether it was a bad deal for the participants. The problem is, as I was once told, talking about prohibited transactions with an attorney, and I probably mentioned this here on the show before, that it's called a prohibited transaction, not a bad transaction. This is simply prohibited. It's not a question whether it's good or bad. It is simply you cannot do this without blowing up your plan. So be careful here. This is issued as a chief counsel advice. My guess is, unfortunately, this is because somebody has tried to do this. And, you know, some church plan is going to be in trouble probably because of this. Well, hopefully we're coming out here on the 30th, the official publication date for this week's broadcast. And it's Halloween, so hopefully you're out having fun trick-or-treating, and hopefully you have fun also checking your state CPA society, mix those two up, to get your continuing education courses, your CPE for the rest of the year. Again, we offer lots of courses in both auditing and accounting and taxes, and your state society offers many of our courses and many of the courses from other excellent providers that you can find at your state societies. So if you haven't done that, go check your state societies. A lot of tax review courses are coming up, and because we do know a bill is going to drop, expect that some of the tax review courses you're going to be seeing here, some of your tax update courses in November and December, will be able to have at least some discussion of what some provisions are in this bill. You know, I'm going to be lecturing at two different tax conferences this week. And actually, the sad part for me is on Wednesday when they drop this bill, I'm going to be giving a tax update at 3:15 that afternoon. So I'm going to be madly scrambling to skim this bill and try to get some idea of what it's like in time to make some statement that makes sense Wednesday afternoon at Arizona's tax conference. I'll also be talking about that same bill. The whole topic was tax reform. I'll be at Oregon's conference on next Monday, so a week from the 30th. One warning, because of my travel schedule, I'm going to be all the way from Seattle, Washington to Providence, Rhode Island this week, and then making my way back to Portland, Oregon. So I'm going to have a little fun finding time to record this week, so fair warning for everybody. Should be able to get something done if at the worst point, sometime late on Monday. But in any event, we're going to hope to get this up and going. But what I'd like to do is hopefully give you an update on what this new bill says. And if I can get some quiet time and be able to get it recorded, I'll try and get that done for you and get that up sometime by the end of Monday. But be sure to do that. So be sure to, if you can, check in next week and catch our updates. If you want to go on the website, we'll write up there at kernerfeldtaxdevelopments.com. I'll post updates as we get there. If I get something written about the proposed law, I expect to have that go up there too once we get that written. But don't expect it 5 minutes after the bill drops. It's going to take a while, I think, to slog through this. Remember, in 1986, the initial draft of the bill that Treasury produced was 450 pages long. That suggests trying to get some information up 5 minutes after it drops. It's going to be a little tough. Also, be sure to remember you can download a PDF with articles on this week's topics. There won't be anything on there about tax reform because, honestly, all we know right now is that they're going to start it. But we will have articles on all the other developments we talked about. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@kernerfeldtaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at edzollers for all postings. And I'll probably try to post Wednesday as soon as House Ways and Means posts the bill. I'll try to put something up in the Twitter feed so you know it's out there and at least can get a link to the bill at that point. Otherwise, be sure to join me next week, some point next week. We'll try to get back together, take a look at the key developments, which I suspect will be the dropping of that bill. And if they don't drop the bill for some reason, then we'll take a look at whatever else happens, and we'll see you next week.